Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the September 7th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist and author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you?
Good. It was good to be within a few feet of you on Saturday, a long few feet of you on Saturday at the USC game.
Yeah, so we never did end up getting a wave at each other. When you first texted me, there's a thing at the very top above the press box. They built a little private club thing up there.
I just want to introduce a graduate school seminar point here. Semiotics. You were way above the field in this beautifully air-conditioned new portion of the stadium, and I was down near the sideline.
Well, that may be true, but the first shall be last, the last shall be first. So God's no respecter of persons. Any of the things you're saying right now are irrelevant to me because I love all people the same.
I did wave a couple of times, but...
Oh, I bumped into somebody that listens to podcasts.
Oh, is that right?
And had some kind words for both you and me.
Yeah, oh, that's nice.
Very nice.
What a great game. I mean, lest we bury all of our headlines and just talk about the game, it was nice to see SC just run over Rice.
Yeah, a lot of people were saying like it's Rice, and that's a fair point. 66-14 against a bad Rice team. But the only thing I want to point out is actually... those kind of bad first games you sometimes play, we've had four of them in the last several years, and the game went very differently. Now, yes. We didn't lose any of them, but we played UNLV, San Jose State, Western Michigan, and another one I'm forgetting.
It wasn't San Diego State?
There may have been that one as well, but there were four of these games, and the first three I know were right. The fourth one could have been San Diego State, but all four of them, we came away with this feeling of like, oh, God.
Yeah, the eye
like not
test.
Putting the team away till the fourth quarter, not looking good, not really getting turnovers. That was the thing most encouraging for me, by the way. I know our offense is stacked, and I know there's athletes, and almost a little bit like too much skill position. Both a receiver, running back, you're not going to get to use all of it. There's too many weapons. So I'm excited for all that. You want to score, but I'm a defense guy. I'm a John McKay guy. I'm a Pete Carroll guy. I like defense. And when you can't stop the other team, it's a demoralizing feeling in football. And I like those three pick sixes, the four interceptions.
Yeah.
That was the thing about the Pete Carroll era, man. You go get the ball from the other team.
That's right.
You don't lose football games when you do that. When you win the giveaway takeaway ratio, you win games. Hey, anything happening in politics, Will?
You know, it's been a quiet few days here.
No, I wasn't asking that. I was just doing my impression of one of our bitchy fans.
Oh.
Why are they talking about SC football again?
Oh,
let's write an email.
No, but there are, and we don't have time for the letters today. I apologize profusely. We got loads of letters, all of them very good humored about the fact that we talk about USC football, slightly dismissive, but encouraging
us.
But
I wrote a whole Dividend Cafe, my weekly investment commentary.
I neglected it. I saved it and I didn't read it. Tell me.
And I got hundreds of letters, all positive.
Wow.
And I was expecting people to be like, look, I've been reading this forever. It's an important economic commentary. We live in troubling times, and I can't believe you did one on SC football. I was waiting for the negativity, and people were really complimentary. And a lot of them were, I don't like SC or I don't care about football, but I got to say, this was a great read. Really enjoyed it. So I was really
let's
was
get
really
a link to that in the, let's get a link to that in the show.
Yeah,
everybody should enjoy it.
Absolutely.
David, is you joke every week that I send way too many run lists, new iterations, just trying to keep you abreast. I should probably just wait until the final moment to send you what I've got, because again, this morning, the news is just all over the place. But I really want to start with a story that struck me, because I'm a big fan of history, so I won't bore you, David, too much with this. But the town of Weed, California, for those of you who don't know it, it's up in Siskiyou County, just beneath, it's in the shadow of Shasta, Mount Shasta. It is a gorgeous little lumber town, former lumber town. And the mill fire just ran through the historic black neighborhood there. And you know that you are living in 2022 because the stories about this fire really limited themselves to its impact on the black neighborhood without really exploring where Weed came from, how these African American people came to be there, and what finally diminished that city's prospects. And I've stayed in Weed a number of times, and I always make it a point to pop in there on my way up to, say, Oregon or Washington when I'm driving. I just love these kinds of, you know, mountain towns in the north and the east. And Weed was founded by a guy named Abner Weed, which sounds like the apocryphal stories of the beginnings of baseball, perhaps.
That's an unbelievable coincidence.
That he has the same last name as a city.
You know that Jonah Goldberg has done that to me constantly, where he goes, David Bahnsen runs the Bahnsen Group. That's almost as big a coincidence as Lou Gehrig's disease. And so you're saying that he had that last name, discovered a city called Weed, or that he discovered a city and then decided to name it Weed?
He discovered a non-city with a sawmill.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, you're welcome. But Abner himself is a really interesting guy. He comes from the East. He was in Maine, where he joins the Union Army and is present at the Lee's surrender at Appomattox. I mean, this is a civil warrior from way back. Takes his family, moves out of Maine and moves to Northern California, finds this sawmill, buys it, builds a hotel nearby, and Weed, the city the city is named, of course, for Abner. That's when the city is founded, the late 1800s. And what happens next is truly amazing. The town begins to attract, especially in the post-World War I era, begins to attract a number of African Americans who are just looking for a way out of the South, you can imagine. Let's not put too fine a point on it. The South was an apartheid, racist place even after the Civil War. It was dreadful. And so African Americans were going north, and many, many came to California and especially settled in places like Weed, where there was plentiful work. There's a great story, and I'll pop this in the show notes, called African Americans in the Shadow of Mount Shasta, the Black Community of Weed, California. This is from, over a decade ago. But it tells you about these young men. June 1923, five young black men set out in a Model T Ford from Broken Bow, Oklahoma, to a small town in Northern California, following the sounds of promise they had heard in the woods of a young hobo recently returned from a trip to the West Coast. He told of a better life for black people in this burgeoning lumber town. He said there was a mountain right there close to Weed. You'd see the snow year-round, said Danny Piggy, that's his name, describing how he first heard of Weed, the town he was to live in for the next 37 years. It was a miracle for black people for work. This is a town that attracted people, and I think this is what's missing in our contemporary enthusiasm and anxiety about racism. This is also California. This is a place where people came for freedom and for promise, and they had jobs. These guys arrive on June 19th, 1923, after 14 and a half days in the road. They eat dinner, go to the hiring office of the lumber company, then to the hospital for a health check, and they start their jobs the next morning, David. They made $360 a day for 8 hours, working, and you can imagine, this is rigorous, rigorous work. But these are guys who are accustomed to rigorous, rigorous work. So one of them says, I thought to myself, boy, I ought to have been here for years back. You could just almost pick your jobs when I came here, and it was a lot of black folks around here. So they had 1,000 African Americans in this lumber town by the mid-20s. And what they also had were immigrants from all over the world. There are great stories about people who came there from Germany, from the UK, Scotland, Ireland, Italy. Among the town's first residents is an Italian family that sets up the first restaurant, bakery. They are a bread manufacturing company. But these are people who came from all over the world for this promise, this California promise. They didn't come here to strike it rich and find gold. They came here just to get work that for which they could be remunerated in some way and start a family. They came here for real promise, David. And then something amazing happens. California begins to regulate the hell out of the lumber industry. Back in the 70s especially, it starts. And I'll pop, there's research galore out there. But the regulatory cycles are really consistent from report to report to report. It's the 1970s with the sort of the Earth First movement and Earth Day stuff, and you get the big environmental push then. And then it kind of slows a bit when Reagan is in office, interestingly. There's some federal pushback on some of this regulation. And then in the 90s, it kickstarts again, and it really cycles up fast. And all of this regulation, David, is aimed at preserving the environment. I'm just going to read from the, I don't know if you can see it, David. It's the headline is Impact of California's Changing Environmental Regulations on timber harvest planning costs. I'll skip reading the entire 70-something pages and just point out, it says here in the conclusion, A clear cause and effect condition exists between the level of growing environmental regulation in California and the increased timber harvest planning costs. California's approach to protecting environmental values was to impose a system of process-oriented regulations that produce little, if any, positive effect on the ground. In other words, all this regulation aimed at preserving the environment doesn't. What does it do? It raises the cost of California lumber, and eventually these towns like Weed begin to collapse. Yeah. So by the time I get there in the 90s, this town has already been kicked in the chops, and people are starting to leave. The town is starting to shrink. And the only real jobs now up there were, at that time, the government was expanding dramatically. You go to work for the county or the local government. You could go to teach in a school, as many people did. Most people simply left. And at the end of all of this, you find, here's a story from April 20th, 2019. Get it, 420. Here's the headline. City of Weed, California embraces its name, hosts first marijuana festival on 420. Mm. The town has now become more famous for its name. Yeah. That it's just a place named Weed, and Californians think that's funny, and so do people from all over the world. They talk about how Hollywood A-listers get up there. They just want to see the town of Weed and buy weed-related paraphernalia or go to the weed shop there and say they did. But that's, I think there's something so illustrative and poignant and sad about how California government wrecked a place that had been a magnet for people who were really willing to work hard, wanted to make something of themselves, and were willing to break their backs to get it done, and then make a real life. There's a great story about the Italian family that settles there. One of the brothers who migrates here eventually ends up working in a San Francisco restaurant, eventually goes on to become the maitre d', and then owns the restaurant in a generation from an Italian village to owning a restaurant in San Francisco. That's America, man. And yet California steps in and destroys this town, which was an economic engine, an escalator for people who came from all over the place. And now all we can do is sort of look sadly at how other regulation of the timber industry has led to these wildfires. It's not just climate change, man. It's also this regulation that doesn't allow us to actually work our forests. And
you know how I know that nobody cares about what they did to destroy the town of Weed, and where regulation, where government intervention led to the elimination of opportunity in a small town? Because they don't care when we talk about it in big towns.
That's right.
So you could tell the story, which you and I got to hear Amity Schles share a bit of history regarding the relationship between regulators, central planners, and in this case, private unions, UAW, and how it led to the destruction of Ford, and how that led to the destruction of Detroit. With the big three, two of the three going bankrupt, one of them essentially being at the brink of bankruptcy and having to restructure all their deals, and the population of a town like Detroit. So with Weed, I think it's an inconvenient truth that lingers, and that they can brush off as, look, if you're talking about Weed, we're okay, because, yeah, I guess we may have messed up 50,000 people, but at least you're not talking about Detroit, where we messed up 1.5 million people. And so their policies lead to big problems, sometimes quickly, sometimes over a long period of time, but it always plays out the same. That's destructive to either small town opportunities like in Weed or big towns like in Detroit. Right now, I think I would argue that the lack of reality in people's philosophy of human nature has led to destruction of Portland, Oregon. And Seattle. Portland is the new Detroit. Yeah. Now, Seattle is not fallen economically yet the way Portland has.
That's true. Fair enough.
And in fairness, there's some really large tech employers nearby, and there's some other advantages.
They're trying to kill those two, but yes.
They're trying, you know. And like people have talked for years about, like, well, they're trying to kill New York. And I've always pointed out, you know, it's very tough to kill. There's a thing called staying power. And, you know, a town like Weed never got a chance to build what Nassim Taleb calls the Lindy effect. You know, it's pretty hard to knock down a place with – it can be done, though. Nothing's permanent. But the more history, the more culture, and also geography. I mean, New York's this island surrounded by the Hudson and East River, it's, you know, all the things – Detroit, they killed.
Yeah.
They killed Detroit, Michigan.
Yes, they did.
And Portland, Oregon will be the biggest casualty of COVID.
Well, and David, this is, you've got it exactly right. And I would just ask our friends in the mainstream media. I'm looking here at Sacramento Bee, LA Times, SF Gate, the Mercury News. Every one of them and more wrote stories about how this historic black section of weed burned down a few days ago. And this is terrible. A couple of people died. Homes were wrecked. This is a bad thing. But every story focused both on systemic racism and climate change.
Yeah.
Not one of them dug beneath the surface of this story to find out where did weed come from.
No.
You don't see any stories like this in these newspapers about how government regulation destroyed this city and left it vulnerable to fire.
Well, there's no reporters like you at those places anymore.
That's true also. They're really good reporters. They mean well, and they are not.
Do you miss the big time money and prestige?
Of working at the Orange County Weekly. I do.
OC Weekly, so named because it was a weekly question if you'd get paid.
No, we actually were wildly successful.
Yeah, you were for a while, right?
Yeah. When I left, we were one of the most profitable newspapers in a very, very prestigious chain, the Village Voice chain, which owned LA Weekly and the Village Voice in New York and others. But you could see the writing on the wall. You had the unencumbered, I would argue, almost violence of, Craigslist and other social media just ripping to shreds the old media model. Violence doesn't mean that it was, illegal or unlawful or even unethical. It was just like, it just came quickly and it just gutted these things. But anyway, that story is missing. There is no major headline that says, hey, look what government regulation did to destroy. And this story shoots off like one of those mind mapping exercises where one story leads to another. Housing costs as a result of timber regulation in California. So where do we get our timber now? We get it overseas where they clear cut, like the rainforests of Brazil or whatever. We don't produce lumber in the West anymore because environmentalists got hold of the politicians. The politicians decided to regulate, and the environmentalists in those agencies.
So when Leonard Reed did iPencil, he now, instead of using logging and trucking out of the Pacific Northwest, he'd have to get us down to Brazil.
Yes.
Yeah. So the pencil wouldn't even be $1 million anymore. Pencil would have to be even more, right?
It would have to be much more. Yeah. Or he could just track down weed sales or something, I suppose. Hey, I want to keep the conversation going here about we've talked about government regulation, et cetera, but and this will be related in just a second. We talked last week about Joe Rogan interviewing Aaron Rodgers and talking about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. One of our great listeners, who has to be anonymous, sent me a story. Joe Rogan mocks Kamala Harris with hilarious new poster for upcoming comedy show. Joe's going to appear in Columbus, Ohio, a week from Friday. And the poster, David, has a picture of, it's really quite funny. Did you see this yet?
I'm looking at it.
Okay. So it's a poster of Joe looking just absolutely bug-eyed and smoking a joint. And he's bug-eyed because he's being arrested and cuffed by Officer Kamala Harris, who is wearing a button that says Free Brittany Griner. And the whole point of the story is that this one focuses in on how Kamala Harris is outraged that Brittany Griner would be arrested by the Russians for weed possession.
Yeah.
And it just points out the irony. This was a woman who, when it was convenient to do so, prosecuted in the thousands misdemeanor cases for marijuana possession in California and refused to go back, apologize, rectify, fix any of these prosecutions when she could have. And then now blithely jokes that she smoked weed too while listening to Tupac and says Brittany Griner.
Which was just the most like pandering.
Totally.
When I listen to it, I'm like, okay. I guess this white guy from Irvine is not supposed to have an opinion on this, but dear Lord, does she have any idea how she sounds? I smoked a little weed. I was listening to Tupac. And you're just like, God, you can't do this.
So Kamala appears also in The Nation magazine, that flagship stalwart of the far left journalism, which used to be it started off as an anti-slavery newspaper back in the 1850s.
Yeah, I didn't read it back then. No, I've read it, it's been complete crap.
Oh, it's dreadful. But they do this just hagiography, an interview with Kamala that appears just a couple of days ago. Headline is Kamala Harris tells The Nation, this is the beginning of the next era of the labor movement. So the very people who have...
I agree with her on that, though. You disagree?
No, I totally agree.
Yeah, I think it's the beginning of the next era, which is the no era.
I think it's the end.
Yeah.
But there are proximate threats right now. So anyway, I wanted to talk about the fact that, you know, she claims in this interview to have been born into the labor struggle because of her activist mother and her youth in Oakland. She says, oh, this may sound quaint, but I didn't even eat a grape until I was in my 20s. And I said, hey, these are great. Now, for those who are too young to remember.
That's a Cesar Chavez.
Yes.
Little
yes.
Shout out.
Yeah. The United Farm Workers.
And she's saying, I didn't eat a grape because I was so mortified by the injustice
by
of the
injustice.
Grape farmers.
Yes. There were no grapes on her table.
Well, yeah, so that's a lie.
Arguably, yeah.
Was she drinking a little vino when she said it?
And listening to Tupac and smoking a spleef.
You know what's weird? Can I make a comment not about Kamala, or do you only want to pick on Kamala?
No, please, go ahead.
Because I think you and I have talked about before the sheer cringy awkwardness of it as a general strategy. The Kasich male, dad of a male, the son of a mailman, the Romney putting on an outfit to go to a diner in Iowa. The Hillary trying to take the subway in New York. And the funniest thing is the one the media's ever most mortified by, they weren't even honest about with Bush's thing about not knowing how the scanner worked.
Right.
And that wasn't even true because it was like a whole new kind of scanner.
Right.
And it was legitimately like this brand new technology
thing.
So it wasn't like, I don't know, grocery store, you check out. It wasn't what happened.
No.
But like, as a general rule of thumb, her saying my mom was this major, you know, social justice warrior, and so I've always been one with the unions and one with the hip-hop community while we're just smoking weed, listening to Tupac. By the way, Tupac died in his mid-20s in 97. Kamala by then was about 60. You think Kamala was sitting there listening to Tupac in 96? She was sleeping with Willie Brown, and she was my frickin' age. Okay? What the heck? But my point is that you don't try to manufacture authenticity because of the meaning of the word manufacture and authenticity.
Mm.
And so, like, to the extent you could debate, because I guess Kasich's dad really was a mailman, you have a different risk, which is overplaying your hand.
Mm.
But trying to make something up.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, my mom was just really the significant labor union activist.
Yeah.
Dear Lord, stop it.
Here's how the Nation's writer, John Nichols, here we go. John Nichols writes,
a piece of work, by the way.
Unbelievable.
God.
Did you read the story?
I've read this story, and I've read him before, and he's a piece of work.
He is something else. This story is, what does Jonah call it? Throne sniffing of the worst sort.
That's right.
It's just weird.
That's right.
There is effluent pouring out of this woman's mouth, and he is just so ready to believe, to a far greater extent than many Americans are aware. Let's establish John's intellectual superiority here, because he knows. To a far greater extent than many Americans are aware, the vice president knows her way around the labor movement. As the daughter of an activist mother who brought her along to join picket lines, and as a product of the rough and tumble politics of one of America's great union towns, San Francisco, she's informed and engaged with labor issues. And here's the pitch to her candidacy in 2024. And she displays as much passion as President Joe Biden has for transforming the character of labor relations in a country where unions have been let down by both Republican and Democratic administrations. Quote, and you'd love these quotes from Harris. The president and I were talking at lunch about this. We are so proud.
And when we were having this fake lunch and having this fake conversation, we looked at each other and said, oh, God, this is just so great. Can you believe how we've done the most ever for labor unions?
You got it.
Well, here's the thing, Kamala.
That's what she said.
I'm reading it. Yeah. You don't have to say it if it's true.
Yeah.
And I would like to ask listeners, do you have the impression that Will Swaim and David Bahnsen have been carrying water for Trump? Okay, now that you've answered that, I will tell you right now that Trump would wipe the floor with them with labor unions.
Yes.
So why? Because he did tariffs? No. It's because people have this sense that he kind of is more interested in their cause. And Kamala, they look at like, oh, please.
Yeah.
And even Scranton Joe and all of it, they don't buy it anymore. Now, I'm not saying I agree with all the policies one may have to try to appease labor union members. As a matter of fact, I don't agree that most labor union members vote based on how things affect their labor union. I actually think some labor union members are human beings that might have opinions on CRT or taxes.
Abortion.
Or abortion.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And they could be left-wing opinions,
that's
too.
That's right. Yeah.
But generally speaking, I think that they're sort of turned off by the same thing that's affected a lot of working class America. And it's not just China. It's this overall feeling that coastal cultural elites don't care about
that. That's right.
That's the broader sensibility. And to the extent someone can communicate that they care, Kamala cannot say, oh, we wouldn't cross a picket line in 1958 right. or something.
Yeah.
It's so disingenuous.
Quite. There's stuff in here about COVID, which she says really revealed, as she says, the fractures and the fissures and
yeah.
the failures of systems.
Of closing society.
Yes.
There was something about COVID that really hurt working class people, and I can't figure out what it was. But Joe and I were talking about that over our omelet bar this morning, and it just seemed like, and when I had my second mimosa, I was like, something with COVID really hurt working class people. And Joe was like, yeah, you're telling me.
And this mimosa has a piquant quality and an insouciance. Anyway, she says, we saw, for example, at the height of the pandemic, that 2 million women had to leave the workforce because a real issue for all workers is childcare. Hey, Kamala, you know who shut down the schools so that those women and dads had to stay home and watch their children? It wasn't the GOP, my friend.
And by the way, the number one thing was not only the businesses shutting down, it was the schools.
That's what I'm talking
shutting
about.
Down.
Yes.
And so there's not, if you talk about mothers in the workforce that quit a job because of having kids, now you can talk about unions.
Yes.
It's called teacher unions.
That's right. That's what I wrote in the margins here. School closures? Question mark. That's what this was about. So if you look at California versus Florida, you and I've talked about this ad nauseum. All of our listeners know this. I'll make it super fast. But red states opened more quickly. They reopened their schools.
I don't understand. Well, why wouldn't you do this interview? Why can't they finish it with their lines from the Democrat debates?
Tell me.
Well, what I'm saying is, what is your top priority? What are you doing? She goes, look, there's more to it than that. Unions know that the whole person's a family
yes.
person.
Yeah,
they have dreams for home ownership.
Yes.
So you guys have really been big on home affordability.
Yes, home building, that's right.
Yeah. And the whole person may have to take care of sick children or parents, period. And the next sentence, and that's why we must have abortion rights for transvestite male prisoners.
Yes. Yeah.
See, your whole entire party platform has become this cultural extremism that no one has any idea what you're talking about. So don't say we recognize union whole people are people. And also, let's now go off on this insane tangent. Her message, John Nichols can write a little puff piece like this all he wants. Kamala can say her piece. I'm sorry. If there's one thing I do know about this, you can't fool them. I don't agree with them on all things. I don't believe the way to get labor union worker votes is to bribe them. However, I do know that you cannot say our top priorities are CRT, 1619 Project, LGBTQIA, and then we're the party of unions.
Right.
No, you're not.
No, you're not.
The only people who care about your message are east of the Hudson River.
That's right.
Or is it
west? We've got a great line in here from Randy Weingarten, who was responsible in large part for persuading the federal government to make sure that school closures were backed up in California and other blue states.
The CDC was asking her counsel.
That's right. So here's a quote from her, from Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Quote, after 60 years of attacks on the right of working class people to organize are making it clear, the Biden and Kamala Harris administration, that the policy of the United States government, that workers have a right to organize, and they're backing that up with appointments, executive orders, and policies. David, this feels like the starting shot in a campaign I'm starting to see if you read the media.
Oh, sure.
To really not just back her up, but push her forward again on the part of the unions.
But then I love this. Like, activists have been worried. People say,
yeah,
the administration's not far hard enough to address abuses in the gig economy where app workers are classified as independent contractors.
Yes, 85.
I'll tell you what people say. People say that your intervention in that has cost them money and opportunity.
There's a guy.
So you guys go ahead and go forward with your damn selves. You're going to put them out of a job.
Another podcast listener, this is not a people say. This is another person who asked for anonymity because he works in very liberal circles, did not want his name associated with this. But he is a.
Let's just say his name rhymes with Tark Tuckerberg. I know who you're talking about, but go ahead.
But this guy said, like, look, man, I wasn't even political until AB5 came down and destroyed my job. Like, I don't have the job anymore. My employer can't afford to hire me as an employee, and I don't want to be an employee. I need the flexibility, and they took my job. This is a guy whose life was wrecked by AB5, and here we go with the nation and Kamala talking about how we need to make AB5 go national. Let's remember, AB5 was aimed at Lyft, Uber, and DoorDash, not one of whom today is covered by AB5 because they exempted themselves in 2020.
Yep.
Who suffers? Everybody else. Truckers, translators, graphic designers, illustrators, you name it. Anybody who wants to work on their own and on their own time. I could go on. This is just such an execrable piece of filth. That's too strong. It's just propaganda.
Yep.
But I'm intrigued at the whole labor angle, and I really wanted to underscore Kamala's connection to Cesar Chavez and grape smuggling. And yeah, I said that because I'm basically 13. So,
who wrote this guest essay about Cesar Chavez?
This is a fascinating one. This came to me from another listener named Dan, and Dan sent this to me, Miriam Powell. I think it's Powell. It could be Pavel, P-A-W-E-L. This is in the New York Times. The headline is How Cesar Chavez's Union Lost Its Way. And this is a friend from the Central Valley who pointed out that, look, he disagrees with her take that more unions are good for farm workers. His whole argument is the same thing, that he's seen it up close, that the union UFW, United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez's organization, now run by his, I believe it's his daughter, that this organization is just a racket. That's all it is. And Powell, Miriam Powell in the New York Times, How Cesar Chavez's Union Lost Its Way, really makes that same case. She says, look, California has nationally, everybody understands, the most generous farm worker protections in the country. There is no other state, no other location in America that has these kinds of worker protections. You can't find these in Latin America. You don't find them in Canada. You don't find them anywhere in the U.S. These are the best protections. And yet the union says not enough. And she says, you know what's not enough? What the union does every day. They do not want to organize. They want to collect cash from foundations, government grants, and wealthy donors. And they use that cash to help bankroll campaigns, to get elected officials, to pressure elected officials to give them more power that they don't even use. She says, California farm workers, overwhelmingly Latino and often undocumented, need a union that will commit itself to the difficult work of real organizing. Now, this is a friend of the union movement writing this. She goes on, the UFW argues that because polling places, here's the deal she's arguing about. Joe Biden has come out and backed AB 1283, and he is pressing Gavin Newsom to support this. AB 1283 would basically allow farm workers to get $1,000 a month as a benefit, but also allow unions to do mail-in voting and allow for, no pun intended, for ballot harvesting. And the concern here is on Newsom's part that Newsom's fine with the $1,000 benefit per month for 3 years for farm workers. That doesn't bother him, giving that kind of money away. What bothers Newsom is the voting provision that would basically allow the union to collect in a non-secret, very public voting way. It would allow the unions to step in and run elections, collect ballots, and then declare themselves the victor. Newsom opposes this. Brown before him opposed this. Schwarzenegger opposed it. This is something that basically it would have you...
It never went before Gray Davis?
I don't know. I only tracked it back to Schwarzenegger. This has been a perennial. It was around when I was an activist on the left in the 80s. And the idea was that if you could compel a farm worker to vote in a way that the union organizer got to see, you would have basically the post-Civil War South, where, yes, black people were allowed to vote, but they voted under the watchful eye of the local sheriff or something, right? And you marked your ballot, and they made sure you voted right. And if you didn't, you got a visit that night from the Knight Riders. So the UFW in this article is just, from this pro-labor person, Miriam Powell, is just one of the most execrable unions in the country. They do not use the rights they already have. They simply don't want to do the hard work of organizing, so they've resorted to being a place that collects cash, spends it to produce theatrical marches and demonstrations in order to press government in California to offer more benefits that they won't use. It is a phony, theatrical piece of politics. So Biden wants Newsom to approve this. Newsom is pushing back. UFW, meanwhile, is also, I'll put this in the show notes, but Newsom, the UFW is also pushing to be the partner with the United States Department of Agriculture through a technical assistance cooperative agreement to inform the USDA of the challenges faced by agricultural workers and to inform the development of the pilot program, a pilot program to make sure that the UFW is allowed to be the, what would you call it, the funnel through which all foreign workers, namely Latin Americans, have to move through in order to get a job on a California farm or a U.S. farm. This is opposed by, you, no surprise here, U.S. senators from a bunch of farm communities, or farm states rather. Tom Tillis is in here, John Boozman, Ted Cruz, Austin Scott, Lindsey Graham. I could go on with loads of other members of Congress and the Senate. But the bottom line is, this would put up an empty tomato can of a union, put them in charge of immigration. And it's buried in legislation now moving through the U.S. Congress. So it's, you know, this stuff about unions being great and they're always the best, the nation kind of model, always good unions, ignores the costs. You pointed out Detroit. I would point out government regulation and weed today. This is the problem, that we still have so much faith in regulation despite its myriad and provable failures. Speaking of unions, new story that's just breaking here, David.
Not in the links?
That particular story is not, but I sent you the Twitter links from Jonathan Zacherson at Reopen California Schools. That's a parent organization here in California that California Policy Center works with. We love these guys. Somebody, we don't know who, public record requested some emails that show that the CTA, the California Teachers Association, is conducting oppo research on school reopening parent groups like the Parent Union, which California Policy Center runs, or Reopen California Schools, our allies all over the state. If you pushed to reopen California schools, you're now on the CTA enemies list, this group of tweets reveal. And the tweets just, you know, they rely on documents that are pretty undeniable. This is from San Diego.
Randy Nixon Weingarten.
There you go.
And her chief of staff, J. Edgar Hoover. They literally have an enemies list of parents.
They really do. Yeah, and they're going from school to school, or school district to school district in California, the CTA is, and they're looking to identify parents. Now, Cal Policy Center helped break a story involving a Long Beach State professor named Miriam Kadrat, who's from Afghanistan, and she got contacted during COVID by UTLA, the United Teachers of Los Angeles, and they said they were calling because they're trying to identify people who are speaking out in defense of, and pushing for reopening of schools during COVID. And they wanted to know about her race, the number of her kids, and she just sort of strung them along long enough to get what they were at. And she said, look, man, this is what life was like under the Taliban when she lived in Afghanistan. I did not expect to find that here. She's a professor of engineering at Long Beach State. And these emails that Jonathan Zacherson at Reopen California Schools is talking about, these emails show the back and forth about how these union activists are trying to work with sympathetic local union leaders and teachers, activists, to identify parents who are problematic because they want the schools to reopen precociously.
Now, I have a question. I'm a little confused with the story because it seems to me they're saying two things at once. And I guess both could be true at once, but that seems unlikely. And I don't happen to think either one is true or remotely true, but it does seem that these people are arguing for both and that they are kind of contradictory. One is you have really problematic parents. Mm. These parents were obnoxious. These parents were aggressive. They were overdoing it because they wanted their schools open. They were coming to meetings. The other is that, oh, this isn't even the parents. This is dark money from well-heeled organized groups.
That's right.
Sort of like some of the stuff that people on the right will say about George Soros sometimes, that they're kind of giving a Soros-like conspiracy. So which one is it? Is it obnoxious parents getting a little bit too big for their britches? Or is it really organized, impressive, dangerous, dark conspiracy? Because I don't think it's both.
Well, I'm sure that in reality, their sense is that it is both. There are, I mean, we've both met parents out there who are crazy, right? There are just some people who are nuts, left
I
and
met,
right.
I met some earlier this morning.
Are they listening
before I left my house. So, okay.
So there's some crazy people out there. Fair enough. But what the left really doesn't like, and by the left, I mean the California Teachers Association doesn't like, and they keep asserting, is that groups like California Policy Center are somehow only alive by virtue of far-right, Koch-funded sorts of things. We're always accused of being Koch-funded. Well, I wish to God we were.
I always say that, yeah, exactly. Like, please, I wish.
Yeah, I'm so into that. I wish they would send us that kind of dough. But in fact, all we do at CPC is work with people like Jonathan Zacherson.
We should go to Koch's and be like, look, guys, you know what these people are saying about you? We should just do it despite them, right?
Exactly.
Like, just go ahead and do it so we'll be like, yeah, look at that, you know.
That's right.
Here's our wire instructions.
Let's make it so. But they really do believe that this is only accountable by means of dark money, because parents simply don't have the wherewithal, the smarts to see through the game the union is playing. But I think there's something darker here, and that is the CTA is trying to silence its critics, who are parents. So this is the teachers' union at work. If you're a teacher in a California public school and you're a member of the union, I beg of you to reconsider your membership today. Opt out.
Well, keep finished. Yeah, drop out, quit. It's evil. Yeah. All of it. My point is still on the table. If they're trying to silence parents, I wonder. It seems to me the strategy to silence parents is saying, oh, these parents are crazy. They're Neanderthals. They're degenerates. They're hooligans. And then the other answer is these parents are part of a sophisticated conspiracy with Wall Street, with oil, with corporate interest. So it's kind of like the old thing people used to say about Goldman Sachs. This is the most evil group. And then they would say, oh, the financial crisis. These idiots didn't know what they were doing. And I'm fine with one of the theories. I happen to know which one it was. But I'm not fine with both.
Right.
And I think these parents need to demand, are you calling us evil or stupid?
Yeah.
Because we are one or the other if you want us
to be. Well, I think they believe that a lot of these parents are manipulated. That they can't possibly, and manipulated by the likes of you or me. Right.
But that is a funny idea of what Charles Koch is doing with his time and money. Like, hey, what are you doing to take over the world? I just figured we'd kind of go brainwash some parents in Modesto.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems like high-hanging fruit for the George Soros of the right.
Yeah, I want to take over the world for the industrial capital system. I'm going to start with just reopening schools that were closed down.
In an all-blue state the second it does reopen, will immediately improve upon its indoctrination of kids with everything we don't believe in.
Well, you and I joked how often that the closure of the schools was both the best and the worst thing, because we know that, you know, we are calling for the reopening of schools that we know every day we indoctrinate our kids.
I'll say this, though, when I made this point during COVID, the California population of public schools has pretty much come back, and New York is down huge.
Oh, California's losing students.
It is, but on a percentage basis, a big portion that went to private for that year came back to public.
That may be so. What we're seeing in California is the move toward homeschooling, which has still persisted and rising.
And, of course, migration out of the state.
Migration out of the state is huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why one of the bills that was passed by the governor this session would allow California schools to measure for financial reimbursement, would allow them to measure enrollment, not daily attendance. Right now, you get paid if the students show up, and the unions say, that's not fair. We should be paid if the students ever signed up. That's how you owe us money if they ever came one day, because that means they're enrolled here. So the unions are pushing for enrollment, and they got it, rather than daily attendance. And that daily attendance figure is down because parents don't want their kids to go to these schools. They're moving out of the state, and if they can get them for a day, they've got them. I just want to move very quickly, because we're short on time here, to a couple of other things here related. UTLA, United Teachers of Los Angeles, came out with its report, its solutions to the educator crisis, David. And one of the things, I have buried this story somewhere, but Milpitas teachers are now at the center of national news because the Milpitas Unified School District said, hey, the housing crisis is so terrible here that we're hoping parents in this Bay Area town will open up their homes and rent a room to a teacher. And the national press is jumping on this and saying, oh my God, teachers aren't paid enough. This is the theater. This is the performance of the left. The fact is, they're calling this, you know, an innovative solution to the problem of high housing costs and the teachers aren't paid enough. The fact is, it's called renting a room. This is not new, David. Renting a room has been around probably since there were rooms or a cave. Like, you know, Og comes out and says to his friend Trog, yeah, you can have the cave next door, pay me in coconuts or whatever. But in any case, not innovative. But it is theater. It's done what it was aimed to do, which is to suggest that teachers are underpaid. So I did a very quick thing here, David. I ran down in Transparent California. You can look it up online. Transparent California, pay for educators in that district. And you throw in all the everybody, the administrators, the teachers, the lunch lady. There are custodians making over $200,000 per year in Milpitas. Do not talk to me about not having enough money, please. Yeah. What the union does is say that if you're a first-year teacher, we're going to pay you at rock-bottom levels no matter how good you are. We don't care how good you are or that we really need your teaching credential because you know chemistry or physics. We pay you by the year you put behind the desk. That's all we pay you for, and we don't care whether you're sweeping out the gym or you're a chemistry teacher. We don't care. It's how many years you have belonged to our union and paid us dues. Your political fealty to the union determines your pay. Not your success, not your merit, not your work. This is a system that pays people the same amount of money whether they're stupid and ill-informed and doing or not doing any real work, or they're really successful and great teachers. You get paid the same. I can't imagine a more demoralizing system to work in where my hard work is rewarded at the same level as somebody who doesn't even show up. So that's the problem in Milpitas.
Are there, in fairness though, is that a criticism generically of government work?
Yes.
It's not unique to teacher unions. Tenure's unique. Tenure's right. Unique. The inability to get fired, but a lack of meritocratic pay is sort of a bug of public sector employment.
Yes. Yeah, you're exactly right.
I was thinking, like, what if a government agency said, like, yeah, we have a boss, and he sits down every year and looks at your work and says, like, you're kicking butt, you get this, and yeah, you're struggling, you're not getting as big a boat, like a regular business. But they can't really do that legally.
No, they can't. Yeah, the collective bargaining agreement, certainly in California, probably in New York, Illinois, for sure.
What about federal? Same?
Same. Same in the federal government. It is collectively bargained. The union controls the workplace and the workflow.
But then some government employees can be fired.
You can. And again, the best
example. With cause.
With cause. But the example that's best is, again, the teachers union, where tenure has made it almost impossible to fire a teacher. It costs $250,000.
No. They're unfireable.
But firefighters, rarely fired. Yeah. Cops, rarely fired. I've talked at great length about Derek Chauvin having had 17 excessive force complaints by the time he murders George Floyd. And who protected him through 17 excessive force complaints? The union.
Yeah.
So you have this radical leftist city council, a black
I'm
police
just curious.
Chief.
Did you look in, of the 17, do we know how many were like upheld?
No, none. As far as I know, none upheld. He was never fired. He was never disciplined.
No, but I wonder, do you think it's fair? Because I don't know. And it sounds like you don't know either.
Now I see your question.
I'm going to assume that the answer as to how many of those were legit is not zero and not 17.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
But he had that, I think, if I remember, this is now going back 2 years, but my memory is that he had the highest number of excessive
complaints.
Yeah, no,
that's
so
right.
He's an outlier.
There were some problems there.
Yeah. So even if he only had half, he would still be at the top end. Half of those excessive force complaints were really true. He's still at the top end of excessive force complaints.
Right.
Most cops make it through with zero
the
or one.
The unions protected him. Well, the unions protect bad apples all the time. That's a fact. I was just curious. But this situation here is fascinating. As someone who's on the board of trustees of a private school, I love this idea that they're really struggling what to do when teachers in the area the school is are facing rent they can't afford. Well, I was unaware that public school teachers were not able to drive to work from a neighboring city.
They can, but the stories all focus on the fact that 10 teachers have quit, and some of those identified the commute as a problem. from more affordable areas. So you could argue
we have got the biggest soccer trophy society I've ever seen.
It's amazing.
I'm quitting because the. Okay.
Well, no, but I can understand somebody making the calculation that a job in one location is simply too far to drive.
I can too. Yeah. I can't understand us determining that we're supposed to do something about that.
Correct. But it is incumbent on us. And if you read the UTLA document, which I'll put in the show notes, it's called Burned Out.
Is there any way
out.
We can start saying, every time you say it, I think you're saying UCLA, and it's hurting, upsetting my stomach.
Sorry.
Can you just say
United
the words?
Teachers?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. United Teachers Los Angeles. They have a document here, which like all their other proposals. They're going into collective bargaining right now at United Teachers Los Angeles with LA Unified. And this document, Solutions to the Educator Shortage Crisis, is a bogus collection of just phony claims. What's the most important thing that we can do to help teachers right now? We just need to pay them more. The teachers are burned out because there's so much expected of them without essential support for the communities they serve. So what do they want? Here's a union.
What you do is you got to force everyone to get more pay because that's not going to lead to a landlord charging more rent.
Right. And it won't raise taxes.
Because
right?
Everyone's stupid.
Yeah. So you raise teacher pay and let's say the teachers deserve it. Like they're just flatly underpaid. And never mind that unequal system that is not merit-based that I already described. The reason you can't afford a good teacher is because you don't pay enough. You don't pay enough because of a collectively bargained agreement by the union that puts good teachers on the same footing as bad ones. It puts old teachers ahead of new ones, never mind their merit.
Here's what I'll do. If you were a teacher in this district and you're underpaid relative to rent, and you have a social media account filled with, during COVID, demanding to reopen schools and get back to work and how much your heart ached for the students, send me that and then maybe I'll consider helping you privately.
I would love that, yeah.
If you, on the other hand, spent all of COVID doing rosé all day with your friends while the kids in your school district were not being educated and you were socially public about how much
out.
You did not like schools reopening, then go find a different line of work.
I agree with you.
The teachers are heroes. It is heroes.
Absolutely
amazing.
They're
on amazing. The front line every day.
All the time.
Risking their life, asking for raises to go to...
So they want increased teacher pay. They want smaller class sizes, which equals more teacher pay. They want to end the overtesting of students. Why do they want that? Because the testing shows they're failing. That's why. They don't object to tests that show they're winning. They just don't like the tests that show they're failing. They say the testing doesn't work, and yet, you know, this is how we grade our students, but we cannot grade our teachers. And what they really want is buried in this document. It's called community schools. What's a community school? This is the new iteration. The union's gambit is always it's somebody else's fault that the students are failing. And some of this is legit. Kids from poor families are probably harder to teach. In fact, I would argue they are undeniably harder to teach for a whole bunch of social, cultural reasons. But the fact is, if you can't do it, then get the hell out of the way and let somebody else try. I can tell you, Catholic schools in the inner city kick butt. They actually teach people. And there are substantial cultural differences between those two systems. And the teachers in Catholic schools make less, generally, than the teachers in the public schools. And yet they manage to perform and outperform. But these community schools would offer a range of social services that are designed to make the schools something more than educational places. The goal is, okay, we failed at education. Let's provide medical services, abortion clinics, Planned Parenthood clinics. Let's provide free meals throughout the day. Let's get a universal basic income, which is doled out by the local school. Let's do everything we can to make this school indispensable to the lives of our community in ways other than simply doing what we're supposed to do, which is educate the kids. We're going to do a range of other programs that don't work. And then when they don't work, we'll say they were underfunded. In fact, I was talking to a teachers union executive last week who told me, hey, the community schools thing is just, you know, it's theater. We're just doing this because it's a way to distract from what's really going on. All right. I could go on. There's so much more here. Do you want to talk very quickly about Angels baseball? Because Artie Moreno, the Angels owner, a guy who was born in Mexico, raised in Arizona, and became a multi-bazillionaire, Artie is going to sell the Angels, and there's reason here to talk about this that has kind of political implications. Let's call it political baseball.
Well, yeah. Have you heard any whisper of who is bidding on the team or who you expect to come
in?
Not
a peep, you.
It's usually out-of-town people that will come. You recall the controversy when the O'Malley family finally sold the Dodgers, and you had a kind of guy who built parking lots in Boston came out and bought it.
And then ran into the ground.
And then it didn't run it well. And you know, obviously Disney, even though you have corporate headquarters in Burbank, you had a pretty well-known spot called Disneyland next door. And so when Disney bought the Angels, it was Orange County connection. Gene Autry had owned radio stations prior to Disney in the Southland for a long time. He had a lot of property in the Palm Springs area.
And then they were called the California Angels, so they played here in
And then Artie comes in, and he was an Arizona guy, and he buys it. So I don't much care for where the person's from. You've had really successful owners from the area they bought in, which is usually where they have an affinity for what they're buying. But you can have other people that aren't from the area and they end up buying it. I'm not aware of any connection Steve Ballmer of Microsoft fame has to the
Clippers.
Southland, and he bought the Clippers. So there's
you've got Sam Welly, who owns the Ducks, the NHL franchise,
he bought it straight from Disney, who had started. They were the inaugural
owner. That's right.
Owner.
When they were the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah. But I have put together an offer. And
to buy the Angels.
Well, no. What I'm doing is putting together a group, and I've put an RFP out to some of the consultants. You want lobbyists on this.
Yes,
you do. This
is
a big deal. So what I'm asking for, I've seen the way the city of Anaheim has dealt with some things, with some of the big, whether it's the Angels, the Ducks, the idea of an NFL team coming to town. Remember, we mentioned Disneyland before. And, you know, look, there's some big players out there that can kind of help drive this. So my proposal would be, I want the city of Anaheim to pick up the entire cost of the transaction of buying the Angels, but I want to keep 100% ownership. I want an upfront advance from the city of Anaheim because I'm going to get future profits, and I'd like an advance of about $250 million on that. And you know what? If someone rejects that idea, then they're against jobs.
They're against
business.
They don't like business.
They hate capitalism.
Yes, they do.
This is capital. This is a free market.
Yeah.
And I would like to own all the concessions, the parking, the revenue from merchandise. I want the city to front the expenses because I'm bringing jobs to them.
That's right.
But I also want an advance on the revenue. I'm going to have to take some loans out to do this. You got to hire people. Even though the Anaheim's going to front all the transaction. If they accept my proposal, I'm going to want some advances against the cost I'm going to incur because there's going to be loans. I'd like the city to back the loan. And then, to be honest with you, I'm going to end up asking for the loans to be forgiven later.
I love that.
But I'm not going to put that in the proposal.
No.
But when I do, can you imagine someone who supports the free market saying, we're not going to forgive your loan?
So you don't
care about jobs?
Yeah, shameless. They hate America.
I also want immunity because if any crimes get committed, look, let's just say it's possible.
Things happen.
I know that generally you don't have to worry about, let's say, some kind of a bribery situation
involving local officials
or the mayor of Anaheim or anything like that. But if it happens, I would like immunity up front. And I need to know, too, going in. Anyone that we help to get elected, I need to know that they're with us on this. I'd like to know we have their assurance of their votes. Other things come up. You get these like citizens, you know what I'm talking about?
People. Pains in the butt.
They come around with these ideas. I don't need to mess with this stuff. So I need to know that I got a council on my foot. And then also, let's be honest, there's some real estate involved here. And you expect me to buy this team and I'm not going to own the real estate?
That's right. You got the stadium.
I want the real estate.
You want the stadium.
And adjacent rights.
I like that.
And I'd like some eminent domain
settle?
On all the buildings around me
right.
if I choose to use it. And I would think there might be a consultant out there. I don't know, but there might be a consultant out there who would help me put this deal together.
I like this.
So I'm going to throw it out there, see if there's any Orange County political groups that might be willing to take up my cause and defend me. And if not, I think you know what it means. They don't care about free markets.
They hate business.
They hate jobs. For those who have been listening to this that do not detect the sarcasm, I admire your innocence. And if you're wondering where it's coming from, the sad end of this tale is it's coming from real life. This is the way some people think now. and have operated.
And it's the way politics in Anaheim and many other cities in California is actually, this is how we run our cities.
And they will kill a market economy if they're not stopped.
You said something so interesting when we started talking about Anaheim, the Angels, and the city council there, and the consulting class you're talking about, and it's not a class, it's a small group of people, we know them. You said, look, I have two questions for most people. I say, are you pro-business? And if they say yes, I say, which business? And if they can name one, I tell them, you're not pro-business.
Yeah.
You are for handing out rewards to your friends.
Yeah.
And that's how this city has been run. So if you don't live in Anaheim or Orange County or even California, what we're talking about here is how politics, this is like the 19th century, to the victor goes the spoils. You control the city council in a place like Anaheim or LA or San Francisco or Oakland or San Diego. You control that sports enterprise and you can control the city's politics. It is really, really dangerous. So, hey, David, can I just make a pitch here? We'll talk about this more in another episode, but we're coming into the big fundraising season for Cal Policy Center. I would just ask people to consider going to californiapolicycenter.org and please click on the donate button. And if you can give a little, it would help. If you can give a lot, it would help more, obviously. But David's on the board. He is a generous backer, both with his time and his money, but mostly just, I mean, his time and counsel is, that's incalculable. So please consider that. Also, I just want to point out that David and I will be at the William F. Buckley Jr. Prize Dinner. That's the annual marquee event in the conservative movement. It's created to honor the work of NR founder Bill Buckley. This year, the Institute honors the work of economist and friend of David's and the show, Larry Kudlow, and also Young Americans for Freedom. Conveniently, the event will be held right here in California at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, by which time I pray to God on September 29th the weather is better. Anyway, we'll be inside. Ticket information is available on the nrinstitute.org website. That's nrinstitute.org. Join us September 29th at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley for this joy-filled celebration of the principles and people we admire. David, anything else you want to add before we scoot off?
No, but I do want to tell them a little bit what we have in store for them next week.
Please.
We're going to be talking about the ballot propositions in California because this is Radio Free California.
Yeah.
And you know what we're going to do next week for you? We're not going to have any commentary on how the USC-Stanford game went. We're going to ignore that subject.
Oh, that's really sad, but okay. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and darn it, rate and review the show. Even if you've done it before, come and rate and review the show. That helps boost our profile, and that means others can find us. Email us with your comments and story suggestions. You can also just follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free UCA. A number of you do that. In fact, I'm thinking of just getting rid of our email addresses and tell people, communicate with us through at the Radio Free CA. We get a lot of great story ideas there. Mm. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bunsen, we give thanks as ever to session producers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian, and to all of our friends at National Review, especially National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.